This episode of the DFA Podcast is brought to you by Fielder's Choice Goods, featuring beautiful hand-cut wallets made from vintage, game-worn baseball gloves. Get an exclusive offer of 10% off their Classics line just in time for Father's Day when you go to fcgoods.com/DFA. That's fcgoods.com/DFA. Check it out.
On this edition of the DFA Podcast, we talk about all the weekend's big moves, including the Alex Colome and Denard Span trade and the Phil Hughes trade. We also talk about Hanley Ramirez getting designated for assignment. To DFA Podcast, you have 7 days to listen to or release this podcast.
Welcome to episode 63 of the DFA Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and joining me, as always, my co-host, RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. RJ, how are you doing on this fine, sunny Tuesday morning?
I'm doing well, Brian. How are you doing?
I could not be doing better. It's a beautiful day, and we've got a full three-man booth and plenty to talk about. Also joining us, of course, is Sean Brody of BP Mets. Sean, what's up, man?
Good. I got to recap your favorite pitcher this weekend. A Yulish Chacin start.
Yes. Oh man, you are so lucky. Who was pitching for the Mets against him?
It was Zach Wheeler.
Well, you can't win them all.
Yeah. But I mean, on the bright side, it was one of the four games they've blown at the bullpen. So I mean, that was fun. It was interesting.
Yeah, it's great. I love reading about the Mets bullpen and how terrible it is. And when it comes to talking about bad bullpens, I think we have a lot to go over today, guys. We've got a couple of big trades that will affect some teams' bullpens, and then we've got some Mets hot garbage that we can go over. We've got some call-ups, some moves, whatever is going on with the veterans on the Red Sox. We've got a lot to talk about today. I'm kind of pumped for it.
You're the only one, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, you guys sound like Jack.
No response whatsoever.
All right, and and we've got our first sponsor. So I'm sure you heard prior to this that we actually have a sponsor for the DFA Podcast at this point. So we're extremely excited about that. So thank you to our sponsor, and thank you to all of you for continuing to listen to us, even though we had gone through a bit of a fallow period with some exciting moves. We got some fun stuff to talk about today. We'll kick things off with the biggest trade of possibly the season to this point. The Tampa Bay Rays dealt Alex Colome and Denard Span to the Mariners for Tommy Romero and Andrew Moore. And they also dealt $4.75 million, the Rays did, sending that over to the Mariners as part of this deal. It's a pretty substantial move, and as our resident Rays super fan and cheerleader for the front office and the ownership group, RJ, you're the only person who can take it away and talk about this deal from the Rays perspective, I think.
Well, it's a continuation of their offseason, because if you remember, you know, they traded Corey Dickerson, they traded Jake Odorizzi, and those deals looked like they were just trying to shed salary because they received an underwhelming return, and it looked like they just kind of locked in on a few players who, frankly, most others didn't value as highly as they seem to value. And in this case, I mean, I don't know how else to put it, because Andrew Moore exhausted his rookie eligibility last season, and he spent all of this season in Double A. That's not a good sign. And I want to touch on him more, but I also know that Romero was not in the Mariners' top 30 at Baseball America and didn't seem to get a reference anywhere in prospect rankings. So when you're dealing repeatedly, as the Rays seem to do, with the Mariners, who have the worst farm system in baseball, and you're not even getting guys who are considered good within that system, I have to question what exactly you are doing. So I just want to address Moore real quick, and then I think we can talk about the more important pieces here, being Span and Colome. He's not that great. You know, if you watch Andrew Moore, you know that he is a finesse right-hander, a small right-hander. He throws like 90 to 92. to over the top release point. But unlike most guys who come with that kind of vertical delivery, he does seem able to locate east and west as well as north and south. But the stuff's not good. I mean, his fastball has a lot of rise on it because of that arm action, but it's straight as an arrow. So he has to locate in order to have any success whatsoever with it. And his secondary pitches, the changeup is good, but everything else is eh. So we're talking about a package that really profiles as like a number five starter or a swingman. And I know the Rays value the swingman type more than seemingly any other team in the league right now. But my thing has always been, if you believe that you have an undervalued attribute or an undervalued skill set or whatever, you do not pay market value for them. And this is not even market value for a guy like Andrew Moore. This is way more than market value. I mean, goodness gracious, they gave up Erasmo Ramirez last year. And I think Erasmo Ramirez is probably the best thing Andrew Moore can ever hope to become. And they did it for half a season of Steve Cishek. Here, they're giving up potentially multiple seasons of both Colomé and Span. This is crazy. I don't understand this move at all from a Rays perspective, other than the fact that ownership must have said, hey, it's time to cut more salary because it's clear we're not going to be as competitive as maybe we would have hoped to have been at some point during the winter. I don't know. It just seems like ownership told the front office, you've got to cut more salary, and this is the best they can do because, I mean, what leverage do they have at this point? Everyone knows they don't want to pay anyone. So this is the kind of deals you get when everyone knows you have no interest in retaining your highest paid players.
Yeah, I definitely think that from the Rays' perspective, you've got to see this as a salary dump. I do think some people are a little higher on Tommy Romero. I know Nathan Graham of Baseball Prospectus dipped in and wrote him up for a 10-pack about a week ago as a guy who could actually reach the majors. But he's a guy who you hope will reach the majors. And Colomé and Span are like productive big leaguers. Like Colomé is a guy who belongs at the back end of a bullpen. Span is a guy who should have a job as an outfielder, maybe not a starter, but he's an outfield DH type who has value to a team. And it just, again, it seems like the Rays are paying teams to take these guys off their hands and taking back talent that's inferior in the process. Sean, I want to give you an opportunity to jump in on this one. Do you have any strong thoughts about the guys coming back to the Rays or Span or Colomé at that point?
I actually have very strong thoughts on Colomé. I've really liked Colomé. I wrote an article back in 2016 about how he should have been the Rays relief ace. Because if you remember, I don't know if we'd be here at this point if Brad Boxberger had not started the 2016 season on the DL and they just kind of said, all right, Colomé, go at it. And then he ran with the role and flourished. It was something that when they finally quit trying to start him, he had very strong success as a reliever, and he really fed off that cutter he has. And I choose to think last year was a little bit of a blip. He's whiffing guys on that cutter about as much as he was back in 2016 when he pitched really well. I like his stuff. I like it. It's interesting to think that an injury might be the reason we've gotten here to this point, but maybe not that interesting because they chose to package him with a Span and get less back in terms of prospects. So
you have to remember, too, that the suspension to Robinson Cano allowed the Mariners to have the budget room to take on these two. So, you know, you mentioned it's kind of funny to think an injury got us here. Well, an injury and Robinson Cano getting suspended helped get us here. So it's funny how those little things add up.
And on top of that, we hear a lot too, especially when Cano got suspended, like, oh, it'll taint his career. You're a PED guy. You're never going to be the same again. Colomé's a PED guy. He got popped for 50 games when he was in the minor leagues for, I think it was a horse tranquilizer.
His nickname is actually The Horse, by the way.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Not only did he get popped for that, but
who among us has not taken a horse tranquilizer from time to time? I mean, it's a mistake that everybody makes, I think. The thing with the Colomé and Span trade is, I really think that from the Mariners' perspective, you can't lose this trade, right? Because you're getting a back-of-the-bullpen arm, and every team needs a back-of-the-bullpen arm. You're getting Denard Span, and we can talk a little bit about how Span's had a little bit of a renaissance in Tampa this year, possibly because he's playing in a place where he's very comfortable, around family, kind of a homecoming for him. But you've picked up two useful players here for virtually nothing in terms of prospect cost. But I found it kind of weird that if the Mariners did have some payroll space opened up by the Cano suspension, that they wouldn't have tried to go after a starting pitcher. Because as good as it is to add another reliever, the Mariners have had one of the best bullpens in baseball so far this year. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be one of the best bullpens in baseball going forward. They don't have the level of talent that some other teams do. And certainly, you know, I was looking at some of the stats about these guys, and Denard Span is kind of like a higher ceiling version of Ben Gamel at this point, it feels like. So, but they're very similar sorts of players, you know, OBP focused left-handed hitting outfielders. I'm not sure why the team thinks that those were the places that they should spend the money to try to fill holes, unless they think, well, we might not be able to go out and get a starting pitcher later, or, well, we'll still have enough room to go get a starting pitcher later, because I firmly believe for this team to stay relevant in the West, which is going to be a really tough task, the starting pitching is too weak in Seattle for them to really hold court with the Angels and the Astros.
I agree with that. Although I will say, I wonder if they feel boxed in by the option status of who they have in the rotation right now, because obviously you can't demote or even send Felix Hernandez to the bullpen. Paxton's there to stay unless he gets hurt. Wade LeBlanc, Mike Leake, and Marco Gonzalez all have no options remaining. And, you know, Leake, you're not sending down. Gonzalez, you probably don't want to risk losing on waivers, and you're going to ride with LeBlanc. Success story until the wheels fall off, which could happen seemingly at any time. But, you know, beyond that, you know, they just don't have a lot of flexibility there. So I wonder if this is them looking at the roster, looking at the option situation and saying, okay, the best we can do here, get another high leverage reliever so we're not using Ryan Cook as one of our setup guys. And Juan Nicasio has been, you know, troubled so far this season, yes, for putting it kindly. So maybe they just thought of it as, you know what, we've overperformed. Let's make sure that we can continue to overperform by really doing well in high leverage situations and late and close situations, because this club doesn't really have a lot of depth. And you're right, I do think they need another starting pitcher, but you know, maybe they're counting on Erasmo Ramirez, who we mentioned earlier, coming back and help giving them, you know, helping that rotation by giving them another option. But it's a weird team, and it's also possible they just didn't think there was anything better than the options they have, because they do have some options in the minors. They're not necessarily good options, but they're the kind of options whom, you know, you can maybe talk yourself into being a number four if you really, really look at them kind of like Max Popsy. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he could be a number four type for them this year. I don't know. So I just think it's probably a combination of those things. And also, you know, you can only make a deal that's available to you.
Right.
And Tampa Bay is probably one of the few teams who are so, so unconcerned of optics that they're willing to make a horrible salary dump move a week after they introduce a potentially cost-suppressing strategy and swear, no, we're just trying to win games. We're just trying to win games. And then they could turn around and do this. So I think it's a combination of all the factors I just mentioned.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's just, you know, you look at this team and you see the holes that are, you know, Marco Gonzalez, who, you know, let's give him credit, has been pitching really well lately. And Gordon Beckham now is going to be in the lineup for another 75 games. And you think to yourself, like, man, it seems like they're going in the wrong direction with the holes that they need to fill. But at the same time, they're not going to benefit from Span, and they're certainly going to benefit from Colomé in the bullpen. And I definitely agree with you, what you said about this is, you got to take the moves that you have available to you, because, you know, who knows that if in July, they may have already fallen out of it if they didn't make this move now, or the starting pitchers that are around in July might be just garbage and, or out of their price range. So I get it. You make the moves that you can make. It's just, I really do hope they find a way to make a move for somebody else, or they find whatever magic dust they sprinkled on Wade LeBlanc and share it with Mike Leake and some other guys, the Max Povsies and the, I don't know, Ariel Miranda or whoever else they're going to need, because there's got to be some sort of injury in the waiting for a couple of these pitchers, because there just always is.
You're looking at James Paxton when you say that. You know you are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, I mean, definitely. They lose Paxton him and Felix.
For any length of time, they're in trouble. But I do think Leake will pitch better. Marco Gonzalez's peripherals are really strong. And, you know, I've been a fan of him in the past. I've always used the Jason Vargas comparison, which is going to draw groans from both of you. But that's a solid career if he can have it. I will also note, you know, I kind of mentioned this in the intro. They could potentially have Colomé for the 2019 and 2020 seasons as well. And with Span, He has a club option next season. They're basically deciding between paying him an additional $8 million to remain in town because the option's worth $12. They have a $4 million buyout. So it's possible this is a deal not only for now but also for next season, although I would guess that Spann will be bought out and they will just roll forward with Column A. But, yeah, I think this is a good deal for the Mariners. It's a good opportunistic deal for the Mariners. And while I don't believe that they're going to reach the postseason, I appreciate Jerry Dipoto doing what Dipoto do best by making an interesting trade.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So I'll throw a couple of other things out here. Colomé is going to take the spot in the bullpen of Nick Vincent, who's down with a groin strain temporarily, and he's been all right. I like him generally speaking as a reliever for this Mariners team. So Colomé is going to fit in real nicely in that role. And also, I believe Sean, you wanted to mention that there's another guy who's been added to the Mariners roster recently.
Well, he was one of the guys who just got sent down. So John. Andrioli? Andrioli? Am I adding enough flavor to that?
Andrioli? No, I think you need to amp up the flavor a little bit.
Andrioli.
There we go.
So Andrioli is 27 years old, made his rookie debut last week, got sent down. He turns 28 June 9th, but yeah, just an interesting story. He came up, made a game-saving catch, and got a hit. Interesting guy. Don't know how much he'll actually factor into it, but his family was all there and in Oakland, and it was cool to see.
And I believe the only other thing that we'd want to touch on here is that then the Rays went out and they needed to get a replacement for their bullpen, so they went out and picked up Wilmer Font from the A's, and they traded away Peter Baer in order to get Font. Do you have any strong feelings about Wilmer Font, RJ?
I do have strong feelings. I also mentioned Baer follows me on Twitter. I don't know why, but that's a fun little thing there. But with Font, he is, how do I say this? Bad.
Yeah.
If you look at his numbers over the last, go back to last season, he's thrown about 20 innings in the majors now between the Dodgers and the A's. And in those 20 innings, he's given up 38 hits, 31 runs, 12 home runs, 9 walks, 1 intentional. And he struck out 19. You know, I mean, I always figured he'd end up with the Rays because he had strong minor league statistics. He's cheap. You could maybe talk yourself into, a guy with a mid-90s fastball who has some rise on it, blah, blah, blah. But it would surprise me if Wilmer Font becomes a very productive big league pitcher. And my guess is they know that. They're just trying to see if they can be the team who unlocks a little bit more from them and gets a multi-inning reliever out of it. But yeah, it's quite the trade to go from Column A, who, if you look at his peripherals, was having a very nice season, to go to a guy, Wilmer Font, who cannot stop giving up hits and home runs and very well could give up, 20 home runs if they give him another 10 or so appearances, which is insane to think about, given that we're talking about 10 appearances in which he's not going to be starting. It's not Josh Tomlin's situation. He would probably be pitching 2 or 3 innings, and yet, yeah, the sky's the limit with that home run rate. So good luck, Wilmer Font.
So are we going to adopt a nickname for Peter Baer? Are we going to call him, like, Big Aspirin or something like that? Or is he not even likely enough to make the major league so that we're not even going to bother with a cool new nickname for him?
I think we're going to transition to the B block because that was awful. Big Aspirin. Come on. Who are you, me?
Yeah, that's pretty bad. I don't know.
So our next big move of the weekend was also in the American League East, also a name you know. The Boston Red Sox activated second baseman Dustin Pedroia, and the corresponding move saw them designate Hanley Ramirez for assignment, that thus ending Ramirez's time in Boston. It was a real disappointing time in Boston for Hanley, who signed a 4-year deal worth $88 million during the 2014-2015 offseason. He finishes his time there with a 103 OPS plus, but that's probably overstating how good he was, because in 3 of his 4 seasons, including this year, his OPS plus was below 95. This year, he had a horrible May after a pretty solid April, and of course, the timeliness of this is interesting because he was about 302 plate appearances away from having his $20+ million option for next season best. So, Ryan, Brody, what do you think about the Red Sox getting rid of Hanley Ramirez?
Well, I'll jump in here real quick and say that I usually get really insulted by when a team dumps a guy before a vesting option can hit. But in his particular case, I do think that it was warranted. I don't think this is playing a game where they're trying to get out of a contract. As much as it is, this guy really didn't deserve a spot on the starting lineup anymore, and he was going to be an issue for a Red Sox team that needed its 25-man space and needed some more production. So that having been said, I don't have a really strong distaste for the DFA as I might with another player who was, you know, like you said, 300 plate appearances short of a vesting option.
Yeah, and I think 300 plate appearances is probably a fair amount. I mean, that's what, half a season more. I mean, realistically, I have a hard time getting upset about this one because of the performance, because of how far. This isn't a situation like Brandon Beachy a few years ago where the Dodgers literally held him down from like May 1st on because he was one start away from getting an extra $500,000 or whatever. Like, this is, and this is justifiable from a performance standpoint. So I don't think the Boston Red Sox are, you know, a team we can call cheap or anti-labor or whatever at this point based on this move. I mean, they might have done some other stuff, but in this case, I think it's a justifiable decision for baseball purposes.
Right. And so the thing about the Hanley signing is when the Red Sox signed Hanley a few years ago, I really thought it was a good move. I liked it. I was for it. I thought that Hanley was going to have his problems defensively, but he would at least be a good, a well above average hitter, even as his age went on. And the fact that Hanley's been mostly healthy, he's been as bad of a defender as we kind of figured he might be. It's been so long since he's played left field, but that was such a fiasco when he was out there in left field. His conversion to first base wasn't the resounding success I would have expected it to be. I really would have thought he could have come through as an actual plus defender at first base, which did not happen. But the fact that his bat backslid as much as it did really was surprising for me. I really thought that he would be able to keep his bat speed up. He'd be able to keep his power and his on-base ability. And that really didn't happen the way we expected it to. At the time, I thought it was a great deal. It turned out, in hindsight, that it probably wasn't. And it may have even precluded them from getting, the opportunity cost of maybe that's the reason why Travis Shaw is with the Brewers and not with the Red Sox today, or maybe it's the reason why they didn't have money to go out and spend on a guy like, one of the first basemen who's been available the last couple of years, Yonder Alonso or somebody else. But, I mean, it doesn't really hurt the Red Sox that much at this point. I think they're going to be still a very good team going forward, so good for him. And Hanley will find a job somewhere else, right?
Yeah, he'll find a job.
Yeah, I refuse to think he's completely done. If you look, he had like an 0-for-23 or 0-for-25 stretch, something like that. Before that, he was 287, 345, 446. So it's not like he was completely incompetent at the plate. You would think he would find somewhere that needs a DH in the American League. But as pretty set in stone as the entire American League is in terms of where we're going to see them head playoff-wise, you have to wonder who actually gives him a job unless they're trying to get somebody, rehab him, and then trade him later for any kind of prospect. I would think, and I think I tweeted this out when it happened, but the Colorado Rockies seem like a pretty good candidate if they can get him for league minimum, because Ian Desmond has been very bad. Ryan McMahon has not done what they hoped for him to do, and Pat Velika hasn't really done much either. So they need help at first base, and I'm not saying Hanley's going to go in there and just absolutely become an all-star again, but he would provide a little bit closer to league average than what they are currently getting. And it's a Rockies team who's competing for a division title, and they're playing, they've been playing decently, and they could really use this help, and I would think he's a candidate for them.
Plus, you know, putting him next to Ian Desmond kind of creates like a scared straight situation. It's like, see, he got cut with all that money remaining. We could do the same thing to you. Former shortstop who was defensively challenged and moved all around the place without maintaining his bat. And I know that was a bit of a reach there, but really, you know, I think the most interesting thing for me with the Red Sox is that this is kind of done in order to preserve Blake Swihart's place on the roster. And we talked about him. And, you know, I don't know how much he's going to play, but they basically made the decision they'd rather accept the sunk cost that is Hanley Ramirez than trading Swihart. So I don't know if that's a compliment to what they think of Swihart or an indictment of the offers they were receiving for him, but it's kind of interesting to see a team as good as the Red Sox kind of bend over backward in order to keep a guy who's out of options and who really hasn't had a ton of big league success on the roster. So good for Blake Swihart and potentially good for Hanley Ramirez if he does go to Colorado or wherever, maybe Toronto if they want to cut bait with Kendrys Morales or, you know, wherever. He's probably going to end up with a non-competitive team is my guess. But if he does end up with a contender, that'll be fun if he can get going. So
yeah, it wouldn't,
a lot of interesting angles there.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all if he ended up as a bench piece in Miami if he wants to go back to that at this point in his career. Also, another team that really jumps out at me as a good fit for him is Kansas City. Especially with the Lucas Duda injury, but also because their bench is pretty terrible. I don't think that there's any problem with rostering him and putting him at DH in and out for Soler or putting him at first base for Duda. So, you know, one of those teams will pick him up.
Speaking of a team who could, in theory, perhaps use Hanley Ramirez and who, in theory, likes to save money and, in theory, who has a couple of injuries, I think it's time for a little New York Mets talk, folks. So the Mets did a lot of things. We're just going to roll through these real quickly. They signed Jose Bautista. They placed Wilmer Flores on the DL. They placed AJ Ramos on the DL. They activated Kevin Plawicki. They activated Hansel Robles. Thomas Nito was optioned. Philip Evans, Gerson Bautista, and PJ Collin were added to the roster. And a couple of guys are starting rehab assignments, namely Todd Frazier and Anthony Swarzak and Yoenis Cespedes by the end of the week. So that's a whole bunch of Mets mess. And I guess we'll start with the Bautista and Flores exchange. Bautista seems like he's going to be slotted in at left field against primarily lefties, although he's seen some time against righties as well. And yeah, I mean, could Hanley fit in here, folks?
No. I mean, he could because the Mets seem to be obsessed with this older player, veteran player, defensively challenged, past their prime, but hey, at least they're free thing with, you know, what they've done with Bautista and Adrian Gonzalez and Jose Reyes. So, it's fun to joke about, and I think like everybody else, we made the jokes on the Twitter and we heard all that stuff. But to me, the interesting things here are, yeah, the Bautista signing is fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. And he's gotten off to a good start. I mean, he's hit so far, which is great. I don't know how long that'll last, but it's a lot of fun. But Bautista should be taking playing time from Jose Reyes. And he should not be taking time from Luis Guillorme. The Mets have called Guillorme up recently, not in that past spate that you talked about in the recent transactions, but Guillorme should be the everyday third baseman or everyday second baseman at this point because his defense is so good, and he has been hitting a little bit already since he's come up. So Bautista as a bench bat who can beat up on some left-handed pitching, because if it's fascinating if you look at the Mets disabled list, which again is enormous, but you've got Wilmer Flores, Todd Frazier, Travis d'Arnaud, TJ Rivera, Juan Legarza, and Yoenis Cespedes all on the disabled list. And they all have the same thing in common. They're all right-handed hitters. So the idea of going out to get another right-handed hitter, even if it was a diminished version of Jose Bautista, I think it was smart and I think it was necessary. So I think this is kind of a good fit.
I agree with that. And I'll just note, they need to stop playing Jose Reyes at third base. I mean, if you watch the Mets, just last night, they had a situation where they drew their infield in, and Reyes is apparently scared of playing it at third base, which is not something you usually see out of big league veterans, let alone, you know, big league veterans whose job basically depends on their ability to play multiple positions, because Jose Reyes isn't hitting. He's really not a good fielder anymore. And you could talk about the clubhouse aspects, but this is also a guy who was, you know, accused of throwing his wife up against a sliding glass door. So I question just how good of a individual Jose Reyes is. So what is he bringing to your ball club if he's not even willing to draw in when the rest of the infield draws in? So yes, I am very just I don't understand their obsession with him. It has to come at an ownership level. And frankly, it's time for Sandy Alderson to, you know, say, hey, I'm Sandy Alderson and we're getting rid of Jose Reyes. Because if you're Sandy Alderson, why are you still doing this job if you can't even get rid of arguably the worst player on a big league roster and perhaps the worst human on a big league roster at this point?
Because they'll say, I'm Fred Wilpon and you're going to be gone. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's how that would go, yeah.
I mean, I like the Bautista signing. I think we talked about it on the last podcast where he could sign, and we all pegged him for the Mets, and it was kind of a joke. But I think realistically, Bautista is your best chance to get Reyes off the roster because you have Frazier coming back soon. That'll knock Phillip Evans down. You have Yoan Cespedes coming back, and your options for Cespedes are you either get Bautista out of there, you get Reyes out of there, or you option Guillorme back down, who has three more options. I would like to think that they would realize, hey, the one guy who's not hitting out of this group, Jose Reyes, we can get him down. But the realist in me knows that they will use Guillorme's option and send him down, even though he's been hitting very well.
Oh, yeah. Jose Bautista is going to be playing third base for them very soon. As soon as Yoan Cespedes gets back, they're moving. Actually, no, with Frazier coming back, that further complicates it. So maybe not. I don't know. They would just use probably one of those guys at first base against lefties to justify it.
Well, their report was when Flores went down that Jose Bautista would see the time at third base that Flores would have been seeing. And that is what it is. It's either Bautista or Reyes defensively at third, and it is what it is. But you're not covering that much time. Frazier's due to come back soon. Cespedes due to come back soon. It won't be Jose Reyes. It should be Jose Reyes. He has no spot on this roster. The only thing they've said he's here for is to mentor Armand Rosario, who, unless you've checked recently, has not been playing very well. So even that is not successful.
I would say that means Reyes has really had a bit of impact on them.
Yeah. I think, honestly, you know, Phillip Evans is the first guy that needs to go when one of these guys comes back from injury. If it's not Reyes, it needs to be Phillip Evans. Or for whatever reason, they're going to keep Reyes around. Reyes should go, but I also think Adrian Gonzalez should go at this point. I think the best thing that the Mets can do to get the right amount of playing time for the right amount of people is to move Jay Bruce to first base full time and have him be the left-handed hitting first baseman and not Adrian Gonzalez, because you mentioned Cespedes coming back. Brandon Nimmo's got to play now. They've gone ahead and given him his playing time, and Brandon Nimmo has been a very good leadoff hitter for this team. Michael Conforto's got to play. So if Michael Conforto and Brandon Nimmo have got to play, and then Yoan Cespedes comes back, there's your outfield. And Jay Bruce has to be the guy who bumps out of the outfield. Now, you're not going to just cut Jay Bruce, so you've got to find another place to play him. And that means probably saying goodbye to Adrian Gonzalez. So I'm really hoping that with Cespedes' return, even though Gonzalez hasn't been as bad as I thought he would be, he's still bad enough that I think that the team needs to move on and give their playing time to somebody else there.
That makes sense.
He had a decent start to the season. He's kind of struggled the last couple of weeks, but yeah, I mean, I agree. There's absolutely no excuse to do anything in the outfield that isn't Nimmo, Conforto, and Cespedes. It's just not something you can get away with doing.
But do you think that the Mets will get away with not doing that? Because I think, logically speaking, I don't think they're going to give up on Gonzalez. I think they're going to move Nimmo into a reserve role and kind of be the caddy for Cespedes.
I think the most realistic thing we could see happen is that they try to trade a young guy for pitching. We know they don't want to DFA guys. It pains them to do it, it seems like, every time. But there's a huge need in pitching, and I think we're going to cover that in a second, but they need pitching. Something has to get them either a bullpen arm who can get outs or a starter who can take Jason Vargas' spot. Other than that, you're just waiting for DeGrom and Syndergaard to overpitch themselves and get hurt. It's really that simple. I want to hope that they'll go out and do something, make a trade, and I think Guillorme isn't a guy I'd want to see traded, but is probably the most likely candidate to get somebody on the major league roster from another major league roster that's hoping to compete. But now that you put it that way, I guess the decision is between Gonzalez and Reyes. And I'd like to see Gonzalez stay just to have a lefty bat on the bench, because Jose Reyes surely isn't a lefty bat, even as a switch hitter. But Yeah. Bautista's done well, though. Bautista has played himself into a role where he's sticking with the Mets just by hitting singles, it seems like, night in, night out. It's forced their hand, and I don't think it's forced in enough. I think that we will have to wait until somebody gets hot in the minors or next year when Peter Alonso forces somebody's hand to play first. Because realistically, how well Peter Alonso is hitting in Double A, he should be getting consideration to take this first base job. Maybe not from Jay Bruce, but at least come up and get playing time. And that would be who would take Adrian Gonzalez's position. But we know he's not going to. We know how they deal with young guys, and that's just not – that's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's now a topic for another time, I think. Because
I was going to say, now,
now
that the resignation has entered y'all's voices, I think it's probably time to move off the Metsy segment of the week. Do you agree?
I definitely agree. And speaking of resignation in your voices, there was another trade involving a former All-Star that I think would be worth talking about, and that's the Twins finally moving on from Phil Hughes. They made a deal with the Padres to send him out to San Diego, a little closer to home. And in return, they got relatively nothing. I don't want to undersell this, but this was just a move to move Phil Hughes off of the roster onto another team's roster and kind of end that period in Twins history. I believe they also had to give up a supplemental pick and a little bit of cash for the Padres to take him on. But this seems like a good deal for everybody, right, RJ?
Yeah, I mean, I really like this for San Diego. You get Hughes back in California. That's not likely to have a big impact, but we kind of joked about it earlier with Jannard Span. Maybe Hughes does find a second career out there in San Diego. Although, in all likelihood, this deal was made for the Padres because they get the 74th pick in the draft. Remember, they had four picks in the top 100 to begin with, then they used one. They lost one, when they signed Eric Hosmer. So now they have four again. And they basically bought a draft pick here, a top 75 draft pick for about $7 million, maybe a little bit more, and a young catching prospect named, I believe it's Jannickson Villalobos or Villalobos. I'm not quite sure. Had not heard it pronounced. So I apologize to that young man for butchering his name one way or the other. But yeah, I don't think Phil Hughes has a lot left. He's kind of been bad. I mean, very bad. He's undergoing thoracic outlet syndrome surgery. And I think we kind of agreed when we talked about him after he was designated for assignment that the upside is pretty limited here. So it's all about the draft pick for me. And I think because of that, it's a good deal for San Diego. The interesting thing is what exactly Minnesota has in mind with the little bit of savings they have generated here. Are they looking to, you know, make a move this season to try to, you know, reignite their competitive flames? Or is this something they're just doing to try to clear the books a little bit for the offseason?
Yeah, I'll be interested to find out about that because I think the Twins are in the position where they may want to try to do something this year, even though the other teams in the American League wildcard picture look really strong. The one thing about Hughes going to San Diego that's most interesting to me involves another pitcher who the Padres brought in recently, Tyson Ross, who's another thoracic outlet guy. And Tyson Ross is very possibly going to be the All-Star game representative for this Padres team. He's pitching very, very well right now. And I wonder if the Padres are thinking to themselves, like, hey, we can fix thoracic outlet guys.
Well, he's not the only one either.
Who else?
Clayton Richard and Carter Capps.
So, but Carter Capps isn't fixed.
Yeah, but Clayton Richard.
Clayton Richard is
very Clayton Richard, so.
Yeah. He's still himself. That's absolutely right. So I definitely think that this is an interesting thing. If the Padres seem to have a clue how to rehab a guy from thoracic outlet, how to make their stuff work with limited velocity, although Ross is coming back in that regard, I'll be really interested because, you know, Hughes and Ross are basically the same age. They have a lot of the same background. It wouldn't surprise me at all. It would be less surprising to me if Hughes was able to rediscover a little bit of his old self in San Diego rather than anywhere else. And Hughes has a reputation as being a tinkerer. He's always wanted to play with his pitches and try different things. And San Diego's a pretty good place to do that.
Yeah, and also, I was just going to say what surprised me the most is that you were willing to give someone other than Craig Stammen the Padres All-Star nod because Stammen has a 1.73 ERA, a 5.2 strikeout-to-walk ratio, so I'm proud of you, Brian. That took a lot of restraint right there.
I want it to be Craig Stammen so bad, but don't, like, that would make me so happy. But I mean, Tyson Ross is killing it this year, and I think he needs to get all the credit in the world, because this, again, you know, I've been wrong so many times this offseason. I thought Ross was done. I thought he was completely cooked after last year with the Rangers. I thought that this was, you know, it's fine for the Padres to pick him up, but he wasn't going to actually do anything, and he's pitching really well, so I'm really happy about that.
Yeah, and transitioning to our next move, because Ross looked like he was near the point where he might have to hang him up. Unfortunately, Chris Medlin decided he was at the point where he'd had to hang him up. And after a number of years where he's either underperformed or been injured, he officially retired. And that's a particularly depressing turn for me because, you know, earlier this year, Medlin had made it back to the majors with the Diamondbacks, did not pitch well in his return, and at 32, he says that's enough. And, you know, at the beginning of his career, when he was with the Braves, he was a really, really fun pitcher to watch. You know, you guys know I'm not really a fan of undersized right-handers, and Medlin certainly was that, but he was very athletic, very intelligent, and, you know, he had a good changeup. He knew how to locate, knew how to pitch, and it's just disappointing to see that after that 2013 season, where it looked like he was kind of you know, placing his star, so to speak, as a starter, he's done. I mean, he never had another season where he started more than 8 games, and he missed time of injury repeatedly. And yeah, so this is the end of Chris Medlin, and it was pretty fun when he was, you know, younger and healthy. And it's a shame that we didn't get to see more of that.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. I honestly thought that he was doing well enough in the minors this year that he would stick around, but I don't blame him for wanting to avoid the grind, and if he feels like it's just too challenging at this point, or it's something where he doesn't have the stuff to be a big leaguer anymore, I applaud the guy for going out on his own terms and getting on out of here. But it was nice to see him get that cup of coffee in the bigs again this year, get another chance to pitch in the major leagues, get a nice little ovation, hopefully, and then bow out.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you guys pretty much said it. He had one of the most fascinating pitch mixes. It wasn't while I was growing up that I got to watch him, but like when I was decently younger when he was actually pitching really, really well, and it was fun to see. It was like a learning experience every time he went out. This guy had so many things he could throw at you. He was too bright of a star. He just burned out. That's the only way to put it, right?
Yep. And speaking of bright stars who have burned out, who make Brody's heart beat.
Oh.
The Brewers designated Jeb Bandy for assignment. They also got at me by optioning Orlando Arcia to the minors, giving Tyler Saladino a bigger role. And I just want to note, Tyler Saladino has a whole Jorge Cantu thing going on right now with the eye black and the soul patch, whatever you call that thing that he has on his face. I'm not quite sure. But Brody, I'm going to let you touch on the Bandy thing first. Please, please try to keep it together while you discuss this.
It is what it is. I liked his swing when I saw it last year. I thought it was decent. Apparently this year it's good enough for 188, 268, 266, a 199 TAV. And he's not very good at catching either, which is not a good combination with that line. So I mean, I was wrong. He will surely get another shot somewhere in the minor league system, if not as a bullpen guy or whatever. He will surely get something else, but it's just, it's not that time for Milwaukee.
Well, I mean, between Bandy and Arcia not working out as well as one might have hoped, you would think that the Brewers would be in a worse position than they are. And they're not. The Brewers are doing great right now. So it's nice for them to be able to kind of weather these two storms, don't you think?
Yeah, they have the largest division lead in baseball, which is kind of funny because it seemed like just yesterday the NL Central had, what, 4 teams within a game or a game and a half of each other. And with Arcia, you know, we're kind of making him sound like the secondary piece here to Jet Bandy. No disrespect to Jet Bandy, but Arcia is kind of the bigger deal here because it looked like last season he was starting to come into his own as not only a slick fielding shortstop, but someone who could hit a little bit. And you remember when he was a prospect, the expectation was that he could grow into, if not a leadoff hitter, a number two hitter who could also, again, be a slick fielding shortstop. And it just hasn't happened for whatever reason. And, you know, he's going to go to the minors here and hopefully reset, hopefully make the necessary tweaks that he needs to make in order to come back, because he really is a joy to watch defensively. And
I don't think this is the end for him or anything like that. I think this is just a momentary setback and that he will be their starting shortstop, provided they get close to the postseason, that he could be the guy who, yeah, he's the starting shortstop on a postseason team. So that's my hope, at least, because I am a Orlando Arcia fan, even if right now that's not a great thing to admit to.
So going from one kind of slit glove to another, just want to give a shout out to our sponsor. This episode of the DFA podcast is brought to you by Fielder's Choice Goods. They're wallets, card cases, and money clips made from repurposed vintage baseball gloves. Each product is one of a kind, bearing the marks of the baseball of the piece of baseball history from which it's made. And for a limited time, you can get an exclusive Father's Day offer of 10% off the entire Fielder's Choice Classics line when you go to fcgoods.com/DFA. That's fcgoods.com/DFA. Fielder's Choice Goods, the legacy is in the leather.
And you know who could use a new wallet, because right now their old wallet is taking a beating? Wellington Castillo. He was suspended for 80 games after he violated the league's joint drug agreement. That means he will not get paid until he returns. So his wallet's going to, again, be taking a beating. Castillo signed a two-year deal with the White Sox during the winter. He actually played pretty well, hitting .267, .309, .466 while showing improved defense. And yet, everything has gone wrong for the White Sox. So why wouldn't one of their best free agent signings in recent memory get popped for a drug? And he, to his credit, I guess, he basically admitted that, yep, he messed up. He took a substance that he knew he wasn't supposed to, and this is the punishment. So does anyone have any big thoughts on Wellington Castillo and his suspension?
The beef's gone bad. It's
not... Oh, God. I thought you were going to say tainted beef, and you went with that. Goodness gracious alive.
Yeah, it's really bad, guys. I'm drowning here. The signing before the offseason we thought was great. I mean, I think we all kind of agreed that this was a really good signing for the White Sox. And, I mean, it's hard to say this sort of thing because PED suspensions are unequivocally bad and they're not good. But at the same time, like, it's not that big of a deal for this White Sox team that, yeah, they're bad and he is one of their better players. But, like, they're still going to have him for next year at a reasonable contract. I would bet that after his PED suspension, he'll come back and be about as good as he was before, which is like a league average starting catcher. And the team will kind of move on from there and be pretty happy. And in the interim, the front office gets to save a couple of million dollars. So I'm disappointed because I like watching Wellington Castillo play. But on the, you know, big picture look at this, it's probably not going to hurt anyone too much except for, you know, like you said, Castillo's bank account.
Yeah, he's not going to the Hall of Fame, and he's also not on a team making it into the postseason. I mean, here's the super cynical take. This is probably a good thing for the White Sox because it ensures they're that much worse, and they're probably right now the favorites to get the top pick next June draft. So if you're a cynic, you're like, yeah, they don't care at all. They save money, and they're at top. They're getting the top pick or whatever. But you're right. It's disappointing for us who are Wellington Castillo fans. And, you know, we keep saying we're fans of players who are either getting demoted or getting suspended. We need to start saying that only when the player's, like, getting promoted or getting a long-term extension.
We've got absolutely terrible taste. I don't think that's in question at all. And because I'm petty and because I know that we have terrible taste, I'd like to point out once again that somebody said that the White Sox were going to be close to contention this year. And I would like that person to raise their hand right now.
I personally can't think of anybody who might have. They might have left the room and given me the mic to talk about it. But, yeah, I was a little off. I'll be honest there.
Still could be coming. I have
only Michael Kopech away from contention, right?
Right, because let me just jump in here since we are talking about the White Sox. And just note that James Anthony Shields, a.k.a. the Astronaut Lion, a.k.a. the best pitching coach in the league, has a 91 ERA plus, yes, and a 3.95 FIP. That's better than his career mark in FIP. So, you know, staff ace, top of the line, starter, he's still all those things. The best big game pitcher in the league, you know it.
I am just absolutely stunned. Not that you would find a way to insert some James Shields comment in this, because that I knew was coming. That we were well aware was going to come through. But, you know, if nothing else, James Shields is also top 15 in the league in innings pitched, which does not get enough credit, that this White Sox rotation is full of question mark and young guys, and the fact that just that they have somebody who can suck it up and take the ball every fifth day and go deep-ish as far as, you know, things go today into games, and then do all the other things that we talked about that he can do, you know, the pitching coach aspect, the you know, veteran leadership aspect. It's just absolutely astonishing that Shields has been able to make a comeback and be a worthwhile pitcher, and that strikeout rate keeps dropping, man, and it's just fascinating to watch how he's making it work.
Yeah, he's a throwback pitcher, you know, back to the days when pitchers went deep and also potentially to the dead ball era when no one got strikeout.
Exactly.
Throwback in many ways. The home run rate keeps dropping too, so he really is the living embodiment of a throwback pitcher, and I feel awful now because I love James Shields, but yeah, it's not going to last, but I would like to see his ERA plus get over 100 just one more time before it's all said and done. And also, we should mention Ronaldo Lopez here, who has actually been the ace of their staff. And, you know, he doesn't have great peripherals either, but he's at least kind of fun to watch because his stuff is lively. And you can still see, you know, the potential there for a pretty interesting pitcher, even though right now his ERA kind of looks like a mirage.
Well, I was just going to say, it's not like they're completely just haplessly throwing people out there. Tim Anderson has played well. Yo Moncada has played well. Jose Abreu might be the best first baseman in the American League. Matt Davidson, who I think we can probably talk about now just since we're on the White Sox, he's hitting the disabled list. But before that, he had been 243, 368, 521. So that's pretty good production from your third base. Castillo has been playing well. Yomar Sanchez looks like he might actually be something, which is good. I saw him in spring training, and I like to swing, which, considering we just talked about Jet Banding, I like to swing, might be a death curse. Who knows? But he's been playing well. I mean, you look at the bullpen, too. You mentioned Lopez and Aaron Bummer and Dylan Covey's pitched well. Jace Fry's pitched
well. Now we're just listing guys, Sean. We got to move on. So, Sean, can you take us through a couple of call-ups real quick, and then we'll hit the injuries to kind of close it out?
Oh, yeah. We'll definitely do the calls first, because the A's called up Frankie Montas. He got a start this weekend. It went really well. He pitched good in it. What do you guys think of Frankie Montas?
Frank the Tank.
That's all you got, huh, RJ?
No, you know, Frankie Montas, he was involved in that trade a few years back. Used to be a Dodgers prospect. And frankly, I think we all kind of expected he would end up in the bullpen. So it's kudos to him that he's, you know, continued to trick people into thinking he's a starter. But, you know, Frankie Montas, he's a big dude. He throws hard. I don't have his velocity on hand, but I'm pretty sure he's still mid to upper 90s. And yeah, he's an interesting guy. The A's have a few really interesting starting pitchers. We talked about Chaminade and Daniel Mingden before. Trevor Cahill continues to be very good, which is kind of a underreported story. But maybe Montas can come in here and give him like number four production. If so, then you're talking about an A's team that suddenly has four solid pitchers. And, you know, that's, solid starters, which is more than I think we gave them credit for having entering the year. So I'm hopeful, in part because I had the A's as a dark horse contender in the American League, and I don't want to be completely wrong on every single thing I say. So, yeah, just hoping Frank the Tank can put up some results and continue to pitch out of a rotation.
Yeah, and he did a decent job shutting down the Diamondbacks on the getaway day on Sunday. To be fair,
Brody could shut down the Diamondbacks on some days.
Yeah, it was not their best effort. And
no. That team can't hit. I mean, the humidor, we can blame it on the humidor, we can blame it on injuries, but they have been really disappointing offensively, and we're at the point now where we're a third of a season almost. You know, you start to wonder what's going on there.
Well, it isn't like they just leave Arizona and hit well on the road either, because it's not there.
Blame it on the boogie.
Yeah, it's easy to blame it on Goldschmidt. It's not Goldschmidt. It's you let J.D. Martinez walk. It's A.J. Pollock gets injured. It's a lot of things.
Well, it's also Paul Goldschmidt. I mean, Paul Goldschmidt's a great ball player and a wonderful hitter. He's just had a really tough time of things recently. He's been striking out like crazy. Nothing's been falling for hits. And, you know, he is such a big part of that offense that effectively, this is a team that lost both Martinez and Goldschmidt from the lineup up to this point, and that's going to put a real hurting on any lineup losing two hitters of that caliber.
Yeah, and I just want to go back to kind of the A's talk real quick, because I do have a question for you. The Mariners are 5.5 up on the wild card on the A's. Which is more likely, the Mariners take the second AL wild card, or the A's are actually in this thing until like September?
A's.
I will go with that they are both equally likely, and that percentage is less than 1%.
You are a trash human being right now, Brian.
I know that I am. I know that I'm a trash human being, but I mean, I got to be honest about this. And the Angels are going to screw people up. They're already close enough to the Mariners that I think they're going to take a position in that second wildcard spot sooner rather than later. The Mariners are going to be in it, I think, up through a while. But the A's, I mean, I really want them to do well. I'm actually rooting for this team at this point to see them, see these young players really, like, come into their own, and I want to see Manaea continue to pitch well, and I'm even starting to buy in on Daniel Mangdon at this point. But I just don't think they've got enough depth to carry through. And we'll talk in a minute. Well, we'll talk in a minute a little bit about some of the other injuries. But this is a team that just lost Chris Davis and Santiago Casilla, and those aren't big parts of a team. They don't have a lot of dudes to replace them.
Yeah, and that, you know, that was part of the problem, not in the rotation, not having a lot of certain things, but I do think that it's, you know, a solid ball club, probably better than most people realized entering the season. And again, Cahill has been so good that he's going to actually be an interesting trade line decision for them. Do they try to cash in on him, even if they're still kind of at the peripheral of the division, of the wild card race, or do they hold on to him and maybe try to re-sign him or something? I don't know. So there is some interesting, parts here. It's just a matter of, you know, maybe being a year away from being a serious contender, even though I thought that this year they could still hang around and make some noise late in the year.
Also, one of the reasons I think why we're all rooting for the Athletics a little bit is that between Mangdon and Mark Canna, who's hitting wonderfully for the team, and Jed Lowry, who's hitting wonderful for the team.
My guy.
I think we have, like, each of us has a guy on this team that we're super, super rooting for. So,
Ryan, how can you forget Andrew Triggs? He was one of our first trigonometry, remember?
That episode two, Andrew Triggs. That's what we'll call him now.
Look at you. See this? Brian forgets his roots. He's gone big head on us, folks. He's forgetting his roots.
Yeah.
Speaking of call ups though, who may or may not have roots. Brody, you wanna sing in our other call up?
Cleveland will call up Shane Bieber on Thursday. We probably won't have a recording between now and then since we're recording this on Tuesday. But yeah. Didn't somebody have an interesting annual comment on Bieber?
I don't think I ever got a chance to write up Shane Bieber for the annual when I was doing the Indians a couple of years ago, but it's so long ago I can't honestly remember whether or not I had something to say about him. But he's been fantastic in the minors this year. It's interesting to see that the Indians would be aggressive in calling him up to the major leagues and taking that final rotation spot, because the Indians have had a really interesting rotation this year. They've had four really good starting pitchers and one slot that's a disaster. And that slot had been filled by Josh Tomlin and then Adam Plutko. And bringing in Bieber to hold up that spot is the Indians saying, hey, we want to have a great starting pitcher every single day we go out there. And I think that's really interesting. I'm really kind of pleased that the Indians are taking this aggressive approach. And I think he'll play really well. I think he's a major league starting pitcher already.
Yeah, and to be clear on the Bieber report, based on what Jeff Paternostro and company wrote in the preseason, you know, he has very good control. I mean, you mentioned he's been good in the minor leagues. Let's just put this out there. His strikeout to walk ratio in 10 starts across double and triple A this season was 20.33. Yeah. 20 strikeouts per walk. And that's not even that far of a departure from his norm for his career. And remember, this is across all levels and across 47 different appearances. It's 16.27. The man does not walk anyone. And while the stuff
profile isn't, you know, outstanding. For instance, Paternoster said there doesn't seem to really be a plus pitcher in the arsenal. That's still very impressive, and it's not the kind of statistics you see even from the best prospects. So I'm really curious to watch him pitch because I haven't seen him before. But I also know you mentioned that the Indians are seemingly saying, hey, we need to have a good starting pitcher every single day. And I wonder if that's because their bullpen is just horrendous right now. I mean, anytime they go to the bullpen and it's not Cody Allen, and I know Andrew Miller is injured, so, you know, give him some credit for that. But anytime it's not Cody Allen right now, they're basically running out some combination of waiver wire guys. I mean, Neil Ramirez was acquired on – was a minor league free agent, excuse me. Ben Taylor was a waivers guy. Evan Marshall was a minor league free agent guy, I believe. You have Tomlin, who is like a human home run machine right now. Lord help us if Josh Tomlin ever has to pitch against the Marlins, because the dinger machine will be going off, you know, constantly. Tyler Olson was a waivers guy. You know, McAllister and Otero seemingly had solidified themselves as fine, the good middle relievers. That really hasn't been the case this season. So there is a lot of bad in that bullpen right now. And I wonder if they're looking at Bieber and hoping that, you know, if he can slot in as, you know, their number five starter or whatever, then maybe they can move Plutko to the bullpen, or maybe they move Bieber to the bullpen. But I think that seems less likely because you don't want to necessarily affect the, you know, the long-term piece there. So I wonder how much of that is necessity and how much of that is just, hey, you know, let's give this kid a shot, because what does he have to prove in the minors at this point? When you've pitched five times in AAA, you have a 1.05 ERA, you've allowed hits in half your innings, and you've walked two batters while striking out 31. I mean, really, what is AAA doing for him?
Just to call this out, because it's one of the most crazy statistics I've ever seen. In his minor league career, Shane Bieber has started 46 games, pitched in 47, and he has walked 15 batters. Two of those walks were intentional.
Put another way, he almost has more wild pitches in the minors than he has walks.
Yes, that's right. He has 10 wild pitches, and he has 3 hit-by-pitches. So his hit-by-pitches and wild pitches equal the number of unintentional walks he's thrown in his career.
Or
in
the minors. Or to put it one other way, he has walked 13 batters unintentionally. He's faced over 1,000 batters. That is insane.
I don't think there's anybody with that kind of walk profile in all of professional baseball or in all of the Major League Baseball system right now. And he can strike out roughly a little less than a batter per inning, which is just phenomenal, at least in the minor leagues. We are yet to see how this is going to translate to the highest level of competition. But if AAA was any indication, he's legit. He's never had a FIP below like 2.5.
I just want to congratulate all of us because we have made it through this far without making a Justin Bieber reference, to Bugatti Biebs. So credit to all three of us.
Oh, it's coming, because I found the annual comment, and wanted to close out Bieber's segment with it. It says, baby, 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 oh, like baby, 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 no. Thought Shane Bieber's high floor and low ceiling would always be mine, and they are for now, if you're Cleveland, with his solid command and otherwise generic stuff.
Yeah.
All right, time to meet Brody.
He's going to get a better annual comment next year. In terms of style, it was very good, but I think we'll be a little bit more complimentary of his situation in the 2019 annual.
And Bieber might be this year's Craig Stammen. The last time he was mentioned, it was 2017, so he missed this past annual.
I don't think that's true.
That means Emma Bachelary wrote the Shane Bieber comment, so good for her.
Sean, we're going to take it rapid fire through some injuries while I go run and make sure that that's true, that there is no Shane Bieber in the 2018 annual.
Okay. All right.
So, hit me, Brody.
We have the big one. Ronald Acuna hurts his knee and back, looked really scary in Boston. He's on the 10-day DL for now. I believe they called it a grade 1, which means there's no tear. That was scary. And then you combine that with the Padres' Franchy Cordero straining his forearm. Which of these will hurt their respective teams more?
Well, Acuna, because, you know, the Braves are actually in the competitive mind frame, you know, the mindset rather. And yeah, it was a scary looking thing. And the craziest part to me was that he beat that ball out. Like, that was a routine ground ball to an infielder, and somehow he beat it out. And unfortunately, you know, the injury is the only thing everyone will remember, but that's just a testament to his speed and his ability. That was just crazy play. And, you know, no disrespect to Franchi Cordero, who obviously has performed very well, but you're the Braves, you don't want to have to turn back to Preston Tucker and, you know, back to that collection that you were depending on earlier in the year where you were trying to suppress Acuna's service time. So yeah, it's definitely Acuna for me, but, you know, I think we can both give Franchi Cordero a little shine here as well, because he has performed well. And, you know, the reputation with Cordero is that he is a good athlete and he does have good skills, but at the same time, you know, there's a lot of swing and miss in his game. And that's been evident throughout his big league career. I mean, he has 253 career plate appearances now. He struck out 99 times, has walked only 20. So he's a real threat to post the worst walk to strikeout rate on whatever team he's on. You just hope that the power, the speed and whatnot are able to make him a playable guy and a guy who isn't going to fall into, you know, the Justin Ruggiano, Justin Maxwell, and, you know, the other quad A outfielders from the past where they had the athleticism, they had the pop, they just couldn't put it together for whatever reasons.
That's a lot of Justins that qualify as quad A outfielders, so we appreciate that. I will, speaking of Justins and of Bieber, I will go back and I will note that there was a line out in the 2018 Baseball Prospectus Annual for Shane Bieber. I believe it was written by Ken Funk, although I cannot confirm that for sure. And I will read it right now so that everybody has a taste of what you can find in the Baseball Prospectus Annual when it's not necessarily a Justin Bieber joke. Josh Tomlin fan club president Shane Bieber allowed more bombs than free passes in the low minors before his walk rate soared to 2.3% in Double A. With impeccable control of fastball with some giddy up and a career 15-1 walk per strikeout ratio, or strikeout per walk ratio, he's worth watching. That's pretty prescient, because he is worth watching, and we're going to have a chance hopefully to see him pretty soon.
Yeah. Just kind of going back to Acuna, one of the guys that called up yesterday, Dustin Peterson, for him, it was kind of funny in the game last night because he was down, he was up 2-1 on Jeurys Familia. Familia threw ball three, and Dustin Peterson, in his major league debut, tried to walk to first on a third ball and got called back and then struck out. So good kickoff.
That's exactly what I would like to do in my first big league game. But yeah, well, hey, you can only go up from there, right?
So we have a lot to run through really quick. We have Andrew Miller with Cleveland, right knee inflammation. We kind of talked about him, retro May 23rd. Rocio Iglesias, left bicep strain. Adam Ottavino, strained oblique. And Greg Holland, right hip impingement. So there's a lot of relievers there. Which one is the most important to you?
The Miller one, because of what we talked about a few minutes ago. Cleveland's bullpen is just complete shambles. And without Miller, it's basically a one-man band. And that's not a sustainable way to go about your business. Beyond that, though, you know, you have to point to Ottavino or Holland. And even Iglesias, if you thought they were going to make him available of a deadline. But, you know, Holland, I kind of wonder, and this is cynical, but I wonder if it's just a way of getting him a mental break where he can go down to the minors and kind of work on his stuff, because he had that really weird introduction to the Cardinals. And I wonder if this is like, you know, a phantom trip to help him. What do you think, Brian?
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all. I definitely think that this is one of those things where it's just an excuse to try to get him right. And I have no problem with that. I mean, honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if something was injured because of how bad he's looked in his Cardinals tenure. The big one for me is Adam Ottavino, who has been by far the best reliever in the Rockies bullpen, which is kind of crazy to say because they went out this offseason and spent a ton of money on improving this bullpen when they signed Wade Davis and Brian Shaw and Jake McGee. But Ottavino has been incredible this season. And the Rockies need, you know, some help to hang on to this National League West lead that they've got. And I really think their bullpen has been kind of is supposed to be a strength, but he along with Davis are the only guys who've provided really positive value in this bullpen this season.
Yeah, and it is surprising because, like you said, the Rockies went out there and they added, I mean, you know, just to tie it together, they added one of the guys who was so important in the Cleveland bullpen, and Brian Shaw, and they also brought back Jake McGee, and, you know, they had some interesting arms in addition to those guys, and for whatever reason, it just hasn't worked out, so...
Yeah, Jake McGee has looked bad this season. I don't know what's going on there. I wouldn't be surprised if he's got something nagging him injury-wise.
I wouldn't be surprised if all of us have something nagging us injury-wise. Even my guy Chris Rusin, who was kind of interesting because he was one of those multi-inning guys before it was like a given you know, before it was a given that every team had one of those guys who they'd bring out there or whatever. He hasn't even been good, and that's disappointing to me because I thought it was kind of a fun little package, and maybe like the best case scenario for a guy like Ryan Merritt. Again, yeah, you just keep tying Cleveland and Colorado together. I don't know why, but there you go. So,
I guess the next thing we'll move to is a Yu Darvish right tricep tendonitis, retro May 23rd. This is interesting because it's the same thing he was diagnosed with before he was told he tore his UCL last in 2015, I believe. The Rays, Jake Faria, strained left oblique. Pirates, Ivan Nova, right ring finger sprain. So this is a lot of struggling pitchers in this little group. Which do you think has the best chance to turn it around this season?
Well, it's got to be Darvish, right? Because, you know, he has the most talent there. And with Faria, the Rays are usually very conservative with injuries. It's possible he's not back until, like, August, as ridiculous as that sounds. But, you know, Nova, I honestly don't know how many people had him on the map. I thought maybe he would be an interesting trade candidate, but with the way the Pirates came out of the gate, you know, maybe they decided to hold on to him. And obviously, you know, his performance matters into that as well. So unclear if that's even a possibility at this point. But yeah, it's got to be Darvish. He's really been disappointing this year. This is his second time on the disabled list already. I think he might have as many disabled list stints as quality starts or getting close to it, which is just an incredible thing to think about given how, you know, good Yu Darvish is. So hopefully he gets back, he gets healthy, and he gets on track because he's a very fun pitcher to watch when he's right.
Yeah, and the thing about Darvish is he is going for an MRI today, so we'll have to kind of wait and see what happens there because, it's not a great sign if he's going to have to miss some time or, God forbid, have another UCL issue. Because when you do hear tricep tendonitis in the pitching arm, that's one of those things that kind of makes you think, oh man, TJ could be coming down the pipe. And if that's the case, boy, it would make the Cubs free agent pitching signings this offseason look really, really rough because Tyler Chatwood's been a big honking disaster.
Yeah, when you hear Tyler Chatwood, you know BB's coming down the pipe.
Yeah. And with Yu Darvish having already had Tommy John as well, that would make his recovery period even that much longer. It'd be 18 months, I believe, then. So that's, yeah, it's rough. It's not good. It's sad. I hope Yu Darvish is fine because I love watching him pitch when he's right. One of the best pitchers to enjoy. But so now we have the A's, Santiago Garcia, right shoulder strain, and Chris Davis, right groin strain. That was retro May 21st, so he should be coming off rather soon. Anything to add from what the A's discussion was earlier?
Yeah, I mean, I think of the two, the Davis one is obviously more significant because while Garcia has a shiny ERA, he's actually got a 1 strikeout to walk ratio. And they have some other interesting relief arms. Emilio Pagan is back, and hopefully he gets going. But also Lou Trevino. And I have seen Lou Trevino a couple of times in the past week, and it's kind of funny because I had never heard of the dude before I saw him. And it reminded me of the PGA golfer's name. I think it's like Lee Trevino or whatever. And yet he's out there pumping mid to upper 90s fastballs like it's nothing. And it's like, oh yeah, it's 2018. They call dudes up who you've never heard of, and they're out here showing like late inning stuff. If this was like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, Lou Trevino would have been like a top closer prospect probably based on that velocity alone. So just a good reminder of how wild the league is right now with velocity and relief types.
Yeah, and to talk a little bit about Davis, I think that there's probably almost no player more likely to be traded at this July's trade deadline than Chris Davis if he manages to come back and remain healthy because of his contract and his ability to hit, which he has proven very consistently over the last 4 seasons. He's going to hit some bombs, and he's going to be an above-average contributor at the dish, and he's not going to play very much defense at all. But he's a guy who I think a lot of American League teams are going to be interested in at the deadline, and I think the Athletics, even if they're in that like quasi-contending position, will be happy to move on from him, get a reasonable player back in return, and save that little bit of salary for the rest of the season one way or another with him. So I would, like, there's not many guys I would give that high of a percentage to, but I would say there's like a 98% chance he's going to be traded at the deadline.
Yeah, if the A's end up folding, they do have some interesting pieces. You're right. You have Lowry, Davis, and then you can even throw Matt Joyce in there. Luke Roy, if he turns it around a little bit. They have some interesting pieces.
Here's the thing, though. I don't even think if they fold, they'll trade him. I think they'll trade him no matter what. Unless they're like at the top of the division, maybe. But, you know, the A's are one of those teams that they like to do the combination rebuild and reload rather than, you know, they like to tend to trade players for guys who are able to contribute at the major league level already. So I don't think there's any question that no matter what position they're in, they're going to be parting ways with Chris Davis.
Yeah, and from there, we'll kind of move on to another team that likes to trade a lot, and that's the Marlins with Martin Prado, left hamstring strain. And we kind of talked about White Sox and Matt Davidson back spasms before. Both are on the DL. Which do you think is notable?
Davidson, because Prado is basically finished. He's just a contract at this point, and he's not going to – I mean, I hate to say it because he's one of my, you know, favorite under-the-radar guys, but I don't think he has anything left to offer. He hasn't been a productive player for a while now. I mean, last season he was awful as well. So, unfortunately, it seems like Prado is just about done. And at the same time, though, you know, you can't feel too bad for Prado because he has another $15 million coming next season no matter what. So good on him for signing that extension when he did, because that really is paying off in multiple senses.
Yeah, so Martin Prado is a former Atlanta Brave who has seen his best years maybe 5 or 6 years ago. No longer an effective player, multi-position, but not really an expert defender at any of them anymore. So yeah, 2019 Mets. He'll be playing alongside Gonzalez and Bautista, right?
Oh, it'll be a great time. We're just being a Mets fan is amazing, isn't it? So Josh Reddick, infection and lower leg injury. He started the season decently, but he has not played well of late. It's kind of surprising because I didn't think Reddick would be able to hold down the position as long as he has been with the Astros. I always thought that they would just kind of find somebody to take it for him or spend one of the prospect depth or money that they had to kind of get somebody of more note. But yeah, what do you guys think of that?
Oh, I mean, I don't know if I was that down on Josh Reddick, but, you know, they have some other injury issues with Derek Fisher on the disabled list because of, I believe it's like a gastrointestinal discomfort, which is kind of a new one for me. But yeah, I mean, it stinks that they lost both of those guys at once, and they're having to turn to Tony Kemp in center field. And, you know, between Tony Kemp and Jose Altuve, I believe that gives them the smallest second base and center field combination, if not in history, at least in a long time. So, yeah, it's disappointing. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, Reddick's a really weird hitter at this point in his career. This year, he's been striking out a lot more than he had the previous seasons. He'd been walking a lot more. He hadn't been making the world's best contact on his balls in play, which is really what drove him to being such an effective hitter last year. So I'm hoping that the time off is going to give him a chance to kind of reset a little bit at the plate. Though he is hitting for power, so you can't really knock that. But I'm kind of with you. I've always been surprised that the Astros haven't wanted to kind of do that dramatic jump up, the upgrade, sign a Yoenis Cespedes instead of a Josh Reddick type of player. But he's a good fit for this team, so I don't see it as a problem. And, I mean, what are you going to do, complain about how well the Astros are playing? That's silly. So, you know, everything's working itself out. But, yeah, if anybody should be looking over their shoulder and being worried about Kyle Tucker, it's him.
Yeah, and Tony Kemp has played well for the time that he's been given, 333, 400, 500, and like 36 plate appearances. So not a ton, but he hit well in the minors to start the year too, so maybe they can get something productive out of him as well. So that'll lead us to the end of the show. We have Alex Reyes being activated from the disabled list after Tommy John. He has thrown like 23 scoreless innings in the minor leagues, absolutely just coming through like a ball of fire. Do you guys want to kind of rave on Reyes more?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great thing to see him back because if you remember before the injury, he was arguably one of the most explosive and excitable young pitchers in baseball. And it's just a matter of, you know, can he come back? I think I just saw that they weren't going to do innings limits with him. I could be mistaken on that. So it's going to be very interesting to see how he's deployed. I know they want him to start and you add him to that rotation, you know, Miles Mikolas and some of the other youngsters they have there. And
I don't know if the Cardinals are going to be able to hang in the race. I know they're already, what, five back now, and they've had a lot of injuries, but at least he gives you a reason to tune in and enjoy some of the other Cardinals who are, you know, having surprisingly good seasons and whatnot. So hopefully, you know, he stays healthy and he finds his way to the front of that rotation next year or two's time, because he's really excitable and really interesting when he's on the mound.
Yeah, I'm really kind of excited to see them using him in the starting role, is what it sounds like. He'll be used in a starting role in the major league, because there had been some talk about him coming back as a reliever, at least to start. And anytime you see that, you start to get a little nervous that, oh God, they're going to leave him in a relief role. Like, he's going to be so good, because the Cardinals bullpen is such terrible garbage that they would get tempted to leave him there for an extended period. And I'm really hoping that that's not what ends up happening with him, because he's one of those few guys that you see coming up through the minors. And like, you look at them and like, oh no, he could be a legitimate close to 200 inning starter with ace level stuff. The kind of guy you don't really see very often anymore. He could slide into that Corey Kluber, Garrett Cole, like ace level guy. And, you know, those guys are so few and far between at this point. You just got to dream on the ones that have the stuff and have the ability to get there. So I'm hoping that that's where he ends up.
I'm hoping too, because it gives people a reason to go back and read his BP 2016 comment, which I authored. And that's why I was fired from BP, folks, because I worked a Rob Thomas song into an entire comment about one of the probably most read players in baseball. So, whew, that was not the brightest decision, but yeah, I hope. And you know, we just talked about the Astros. Forrest Whitley is also in that conversation, right? As a guy who could potentially grow into a more traditional front of the rotation type. So few and far between, few gunslingers left in the West, but hopefully some of these youngsters take the mantle from guys like Verlander and you know, other certain Hall of Famers like James Shields and whatnot, and we aren't left with an extinction level event or whatever for, you know, dependable frontline workhorses, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Do you guys realize how many strikeouts Reyes had in his 23 relief innings to come back from Tommy John?
Nope. Tell me about it.
44 strikeouts in 23 innings.
That'll do.
That's not bad. And they were all as a starter. So,
yeah.
Pretty cool. So
he gets the start on Wednesday against the Brewers. I will be watching.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. And so on that note, we will call it an episode. Thank you all for listening. Once again, thank you, RJ and Sean, for joining the show and talking about both the exciting Alex Reyes types and the Tyler Saladino types. Everybody is represented on DFA Podcast, except maybe the Tigers. The Tigers are pretty terrible. But everybody else is represented on the DFA Podcast. If you want more transaction analysis, stop by Baseball Prospectus. We've got some pieces up today. Two pieces recently, by the time you're listening to this, on Mariners and on Jose Bautista and on some other stuff, written by folks like Nathan Bishop and Patrick Dubuque and myself. So go ahead and check that out. Check out all of the great content at cbssports.com/MLB, where you can find all of RJ's writing. Check out BP Mets to find Sean's work, where he'll recap every Julius Chacin start, at least that the Mets face, which is, you know, all we can really ask for. If you want to know more about the podcast, you can find us at Baseball Prospectus. You can find us on Twitter at DFA Podcast, and you can email the show at dfa@baseballprospectus.com. And thank you again to our sponsor. We really appreciate you. Well, thanks a lot, everyone, and we'll catch you next week.